and backgrounds gather on the streets, setting up makeshift iftar meals to break their fast during Ramadan. These gatherings were not just about sharing food, they were about sharing solidarity, empathy and hope for the people of Gaza.
This is a message from D Chowk, Islamabad, Pakistan, that we are with you. Our hearts are beating in Gaza, and for the regimes across the globe, our message is that you have been exposed. Your so-called democracy, your so-called freedom of speech, your so-called international humanitarian law are badly exposed.
Images of destruction and suffering from the Israeli war sparked a wave of empathy among people from various walks of life in Pakistan, prompting them to increase their advocacy campaign within their communities for the plight of oppressed people in Gaza.
The gesture of Pakistanis holding protest demonstrations and breaking their fasts on the streets to show solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza underscores their steadfast commitment to amplifying voices against Israel's ongoing genocide and advocating for a ceasefire. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Israeli regime has shown that it is not interested in reaching a ceasefire deal, as announced by Hamas's senior rep in Lebanon, Osama Hamdan. One reason would be since it would prevent the genocidal aggression and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from continuing. Is this what Israel is after? Does the targeting of aid and aid workers also support that? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the Israeli regime is doing all that it can to extinguish Palestinians on the eve of Quds Day rallies and with the six-month starting date of the U.S. Israeli genocidal war coming up. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Ken Stone, Executive Committee Member at Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joins us from Hamilton. Also joining us is Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Taking a look at what I mentioned in the intro, and that were the statements that came from Osama Hamdan, who's a senior rep in Lebanon, based on the most recent developments concerning the genocidal war. One of the most significant aspects of what he made known in his speech was the fact that Hamas is still at the negotiating table when it comes to this ceasefire. In terms of some of the different parameters that were presented, he said that they were still sticking with what they had presented prior. Things like for the Israeli regime forces to be removed from the Gaza Strip, for there to be obviously some kind of route for the residents of the Gaza Strip to return, especially, he noted, the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and for aid to be delivered, amongst many others. But overall, he mentioned the fact that it doesn't seem like Israel is interested in any type of agreement at this point, putting the blame on the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and also the fact that any type of ceasefire, as mentioned in the intro, would prevent the genocide from continuing. So let's bring in now Ken Stone from Executive Committee, a member of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us. Ken Stone, welcome. This ceasefire that was mentioned by Osama Hamdan in Beirut, he said squarely the blame falls on Israel, that it's not after reaching a ceasefire, and then blaming the Prime Minister Netanyahu. We know that Netanyahu's political career is hanging on this, but the mere fact that he said Israel is not interested because that would prevent the regime from continuing its genocide speaks volumes. What do you think of his statement there?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me and wish everybody Ramadan Mubarak. On the question of the ceasefire, Israel does not want a ceasefire for a number of reasons. The first reason is that it wants to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza, just as it wants to ethnically cleanse them from the West Bank as well, where they've conducted in the last 6 months some 300 murders of Palestinian residents there. They don't want a ceasefire because they want to destroy they want to destroy the resistance to Israel in the West, in Gaza, which is of course Hamas, part of the axis of resistance to Zionism and U.S. imperialism in West Asia. They'd like very much to wipe out Hamas. So, thirdly, they'd like to take over the Gaza Strip because it has an offshore gas field that Israel would like to exploit. And
okay, looks like your connection with Kent Stone is not working. Let's go to you, Zakir Ahmed. You know, this thing with the World Central Kitchen Convoy, I think we lost actually both. So I was just going to get into the whole issue of the World Kitchen Convoy that was targeted by Israel. The whole scenario regarding that is basically falls into two parts. One, why was this convoy targeted when the coordinates were given to the Israeli regime? And secondly, given the fact that this was U.S.-based and you had nationals on there, such as from the U.K. and from other countries, it doesn't seem like that even prevented Israel from not targeting it. Which brings about then the conclusion that has been made, some say speculation, but it's a conclusion that has been made by many, as to the fact that Israel does not want any type of aid to be distributed inside the Gaza Strip. This then lends a hand to the starvation that's happening more so in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, where it's showing itself. We have upwards, or the average median, of about 700,000 Palestinians who are grappling with life and death because they're starving. I think around 50 so far have died as a result of starvation. But that number can quickly escalate given the fact that the aid that's reaching into the Gaza Strip is not enough. So that's one of the things that needs to be analyzed and dissected. Another aspect of this war, which has been ongoing now in terms of the complicity, is from the U.S. We are going to be looking at how that is fueling the genocide that's taking place. Even on the day that the convoy incident happened and the U.S. President Joe Biden came out and was in a heartfelt message, showed sympathy for what happened, the U.S. signed off on more military assistance. So at this point, that puts into question the sincerity of the U.S., even though many have said that the U.S. is not sincere, that what it says out in the open or in public or to the media is not what it says to the Israeli regime and how it acts with the Israeli regime in terms of the assistance that it gives that. The whole issue of aid, of course, is very pivotal to the existence of Palestinians. We're looking at the aid workers to have been targeted in large numbers. Kent Stone, unfortunately, you got cut off. I believe maybe it's best for you to continue from where you got cut off, if you remember.
I was saying that the that Israel doesn't want a ceasefire for the simple reasons that they would like to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza. They would like to destroy the resistance in the form of Hamas. They would like to get their hands on the offshore oil gas fields off Gaza. And they have this greater, they have this colonial project, and they've had it for over a century. They want to create a greater Israel that is clear of the people of Arabs, whom the Israeli government, in the words of Defense Minister Gallant, considers to be subhuman, human animals. So this is the reason that the, besides Netanyahu's own personal ambitions and survival instincts, that the Israeli government is not in favor at all of a ceasefire.
All right, we're going to hopefully touch on some of those topics because maybe that gives an explanation as to why you're killing so many civilians from the Israeli regime side. But taking a look at the whole World Central Kitchen convoy incidents there, Zakir Ahmed. What is the story there? I mean, the coordinates were given to the Israeli regime, yet it was targeted. We're looking at the fact that even Israeli regime spokesperson, I believe, of the army came out and apologized. Didn't do that for the 32,000, 33,000 Palestinians that have been killed. But more and more now, conclusions are being reached that Israel does not want any type of aid, especially food, to be distributed in the Gaza Strip. And of course, with a record number of aid workers to have been killed so far, is that what Israel wants because it wants the genocide to continue?
The strike on the aid workers distributing food, we believe that they had certain tons of food with them at the time and they were transporting them. The entire trip was coordinated with the Israeli regime. They were notified of the route and they had been tracking the convoy for some period of time. Therefore, the argument that this was an accidental strike can be thrown into the bin. This is intentional, but we have to look at the timing. I believe the timing is particularly significant. The incident that preceded this was the attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran's consulate in Damascus. And this is an egregious violation of international law. It is precisely because of the protections of embassies and consulates that we don't have mass violations. For example, Julian Assange, when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, the foreign powers could not intervene and extract him from there. This underscores the importance of diplomatic sites and access and protections. So when this strike took place in the afternoon, approximately at 5 p.m., Israel needed a distraction. And one of the other distractions that they could conjure up at short notice was to strike this particular aid convoy. We noticed on social media that the attention shifted very quickly from the strikes in Damascus to the atrocities of striking aid workers. This was merely a tactic by Israel to distribute some of the pressure they had obtained or received after they had committed such an egregious act. But going to the other point, Israel has systematically targeted the United Nations Relief Works Agency. It is their campaign to deconstruct every form of aid-giving organization, including this particular one. Their aim is to create a puppet regime. We know that they have made attempts to shape the ground by co-opting tribal leaders, clan leaders, trying to convince them to distribute the aid and to turn their backs on the resistance. This has been openly rejected by the clan leaders, stating very clearly that they would never abandon the resistance and they would never betray them. So this is all part of a grand scheme to deconstruct any aid organization and also to deconstruct UNRWA. But in this particular instance, I believe it was meant to be a distraction to distract from the blatant violations of international law that was committed in Syria in the afternoon.
Well, I was going to get into the Iranian consular building a little later, but let's get into it since our guest mentioned it there, Kent Stone. Of course, if you agree with what our guest there said, whether it was a distraction or it could also, as some have said, is the Israeli regime feeling defeated, whether it's on the ground in the Gaza Strip and the fact that it is fighting on multiple fronts. In particular, the one that's obviously a big threat to it is Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, and it's also on the receiving end of the resistance groups regionally that are targeting Israel, now more so than ever. In the past week, the Islamic resistance of Iraq, from the Haifa airport to the Haifa refinery, I believe, or that was before. Anyways, it's on the receiving end of it. In the past week is just one example of it. Do you think that it's because of that that it wants to detract the world and then start a regional war, where some say, to bring in the U.S.?
Well, I agree that what the Israelis are trying to do by attacking the consulate in Damascus, which is a blatant violation of international law and actually a casus belli and grounds for a war, an act of war, is because Israel would like to change the narrative. Israel is desperately striking out in all directions because it is not winning the war in Gaza against Hamas. Hamas is still holding its own. It is not winning the war against Hezbollah. Hezbollah is responding tit for tat to all the provocations by Israel. In the Red Sea, Ansarallah has turned the port of Eilat into a ghost town. So Israel is getting more and more desperate and is looking to strike out against Iran and to change the narrative. The narrative of the world now is that Israel is a settler colonial state, a racist enterprise, something that doesn't deserve to exist any more than the apartheid regime in South Africa. This does not mean that all the Israelis have to be wiped out. It means that the government of the apartheid regime in Israel has to go and be replaced, hopefully, with a Palestinian state in all of historic Palestine. The U.S. Is in this deeply because of hegemony. The U.S. had undisputed hegemony over West Asia for about 75 years following World War II. And right now, they only have one reliable ally left there, a really reliable ally, and that is the State of Israel. So they are working hand in glove with the State of Israel to resupply it with all the munitions that they could possibly want, and even send more aircraft, the recently announced long-range attack aircraft, which could be used, right, theoretically, against Iran. So the U.S. is behind this, and the U.S., I'm sure, gave the green light to the attack on Damascus because they, too, want to change the narrative and make Iran the bad guy in West Asia, when actually it's the U.S. and Israel.
Well, you know, if there's anything that needs support of that statement made there by Ken Stone, Zaki Ahmad, is the fact that on the same day that the World Kitchen Workers were killed, the U.S. actually agreed to more military aid for Israel. So that kind of shows exactly where the U.S. intentions are. And what the U.S. President Joe Biden says out in the public, as I said before, is not what's going on behind closed doors. The military aid is very pivotal because without it, Israel can't continue what it's doing. We're looking at an average of between 52 Palestinians being killed every 24 hours, let alone the structural damage that's taking place there. What is U.S.'s goal when it comes to this genocidal war? Is it drawing up plans, military plans, with Israel as to how it proceeds?
Most definitely. The integration between Israel and the United States reached its pinnacle during the Trump administration. We know that there was an integration of Israel into the central command structures, and there was an integration of air defense radars, etc., during this particular period. So this is an old relationship that has only grown from strength to strength. And the fact that the United States has provided diplomatic cover to Israel when the most grotesque violations have been taking place, despite the ICJ's ruling that there's a plausible case for genocide, despite the fact that they have not complied with the United Nations Security Council resolution, which the United States abstained from. And this was a plan, it was by design. However, even that Israel was not willing to come to the table for. This is an indication that both the United States and Israel are working together towards a regional restructuring. It is very clear that Israel is an extension of U.S. foreign policy within the region and a projection of American power. When we see these weapons packages going forward, and if we look at what was given, it was F-35s that will be converted to F-35Is, the Israeli variant. You will look at the bombs 1,800 and a few others. There's conversions of these dumb bombs to smart weapons with glide kits. These indicate precision strike capabilities. This is not for Gaza. Gaza has been pulverized. They've dropped the equivalent of between 2 to 4 Nagasaki Hiroshima size bombs on Gaza. And it's very clear when you look at the aerial footage and you study the maps of Gaza and the satellite imagery. country, that there's not much left of Gaza, and yet the resistance continues to organically grow from the ground and continues to defeat Israeli armor and personnel on a daily basis. So it therefore begs the question, what was this for? And I think you've hit the nail on the head when you look at the timing. You look at the strike on the consulate, the respected general, I believe his janazah was held this evening, the funeral prayer, and this is an indication that they wanted to strike the individual that was in charge of the northern front and as well as ground forces in Syria. They then proceeded to strike these aid workers, and then you get the aid packages that are coming in. It's to try and shift the Islamic Republic as well as the axis of resistance away from the war theory of attrition and destruction over time to a more offensive war. What it does open up, though, is that Israel is a state that has become a lunatic state. It is committing genocide, number one. Number two, it holds itself up to no rules in terms of international law, violating a diplomatic site and killing such a high-ranking individual. The next best thing that they could do is assassinate a president or a senior minister. That is how ridiculous the actions of Israel are, and yet the United States has failed to rein them in. Therefore, I look at the United States and Israel as one in the same, and the defeat of Israel will be the defeat of the empire. What we need to understand is this is not about Gaza. It's not about even the axis of resistance. It's about the empire versus the global south, those that are oppressed versus those that are arrogantly demonstrating their power and oppressing those around the world. That's the real battle we're facing today.
Yeah, Ken Stone, now, the reshaping of the landscape of the region, I believe, is one of the things that you mentioned that may be one of the reasons, if not a key reason, for Israel to continue its genocide in the Gaza Strip. We know that it wants to carve out a buffer zone and wants participation of certain Arab countries. That's not going to happen based on what's the response has been. But there's another aspect to this, which is this trade route. This has been discussed and presented before, the India, Middle East, Europe, economic corridor. And I don't believe that that's going to happen either, because it has to involve Saudi Arabia. And at this point, Saudi Arabia is not very receptive to what Israel has done. So do you think that Israel is going to continue with these aspirations in mind, in terms of trade, for example, to basically want to push the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip and then maybe go through with that trade route?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I agreed with every word of your other guest about the U.S. and Israel trying to change the landscape of the what we called, or the British called, the Middle East, West Asia, and North Africa. And they have been doing that since the war on terror was announced by George Bush. Of course, it was not a war on terror. It was a war of terror against the mainly Muslim people of West Asia, go all the way from Afghanistan, across Iraq and Syria, and of course, all the way to Libya. And that plan has not gone away. The U.S. has murdered millions of people in that war of terror. And they have spent trillions of dollars, and they are still occupying Syria, the eastern third of Syria. Their troops are still in Iraq. They have bases circling Iran, and they are in Palestine working their best to help the Israelis create. Okay. The so-called Greater Israel. So yes, they are still continuing their project in East Asia.
So Kamet, I'm going to end with you. We're looking at a good day tomorrow. So I'm wondering how that's going to transpire, given the fact that Iran's leader has said that we need to have this support of people around the world, which obviously the Palestinian cause has been getting. What is your projection about what's going to happen tomorrow when it comes to the Quds Day rallies?
I think it's going to be one of the most important Quds days that we will ever experience. The battle is raging on. It's the battle not just for the soul of Palestine, it's the soul of each and every one of us. Those that believe in truth, those that believe in justice, those that believe that there is accountability in this world and that one cannot believe that you are superior to another. And I believe this is going to be a watershed moment in South Africa, Johannesburg. I know that there are Goods Day events and protests taking place outside the U.S. consulate. The United States and Israel is being viewed as one in the same. These are the perpetrators of atrocities, genocide, and violations of all peoples around the world. The Israelis have also become victim to the apartheid mentality and colonialism, as South African, white South Africans were also victims of that, indoctrinated and brought onto the wrong side of history. Al-Quds Day is going to define the world today, tomorrow, and I believe that it is important for each and every one to participate in whichever way they can.
Thank you for that. Zakir Ahmed Mayat, we appreciate it. Attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg. Ken Stone, sorry, we're just out of time. I can give you about 15 seconds if you want, only.
It'll be a defining moment tomorrow and on Saturday in Toronto as well, because we're marshaling lots of people in view of the fact that the police attacked a peaceful pro-Palestinian protest last Saturday. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Kent Stone, Executive Committee Member, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IOIB English Radio.
IOIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
7 damage pressure.
We come to you, and O God, name that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. We are coming to the end of the blessed month of Ramadan, and we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to accept our small efforts and the little that we have done, and inshallah grant us great blessings for the little that we have done, because it is in His nature to give a lot in exchange for a little, as we have read in the dua of Rajab. Also, today is the day where the Muslim Ummah stands up and shows its support for the oppressed throughout the world, whether the oppressed is Muslim or not. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that because of this blessed month of Ramadan and the coming together of the hearts of those who are fasting and raising their voices as one in support of the mustadhafin, or the oppressed on earth, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because of this day, because of these people, because of the coming together of such a great amount of people and what they are doing, that victory is given to the oppressed and to those who are truly the mustadafin on earth, inshaAllah. Also, the final dua that we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this, or rather in these last days of the blessed month of Ramadan, is that He hastens the reappearance of our Imam wa Sahib al-Asri wa al-Zaman, so that this is the last Shahr Ramadan that we have without our master and the Imam of the age, inshallah. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a very spiritual book. You call it a mystical book. It is not for everybody to read, obviously. but we'll introduce it nonetheless. And hopefully those who can benefit will benefit, inshallah. So we'll do so in our next segment, inshallah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Ibn al-Arabi on the Mysteries of Fasting from the Futuhat al-Makkiyah, or what is known as the Meccan Revelations. Now it is important to understand what the Futuhat al-Makkiyah is. It is the encyclopedic work, or as you call it, the magnus opus of Ibn Arabi. It contains all of his ideas. It is not a book that is a textbook. It is a book that contains his ideas, his certain revelations and ilhamat and makashifat and his divine illuminations that he saw. And he wrote them down, secrets that he was given, and so on and so forth. The Futuhat al-Makkiyah is not a book that is taught. It is a book that is read by those who have gone through the entirety of theoretical mysticism and the studies of theoretical mysticism. It is then read as a research work, and a person kind of fills in the gaps with regards to theoretical mysticism. So, like I mentioned, it is not a book for everybody, but it has been translated into English. Whose particular translation has been done by Aisha Biuli. It has been edited by Leila Bakhtiar, and the series editor of the Ibn Arabi works, or this Futuhat al-Makkiyah works, was Sayyid Hussein Nasser. This book was published by Great Books of the Islamic World, Qazi Publications, which is based in the United States of America. So this book goes through certain aspects of fasting in a esoteric manner. So for example, it first begins with the introduction by Ibn Arabi, and this is chapter 71 of the Meccan Revelations, which is about 500 chapters, but over 500 chapters, if I'm not mistaken. This is number 71 that deals with fasting. Again, there may be differences when a person compares the different versions of the manuscripts of Futuhat al-Makkiyah. There may be versions, but I have not checked, so I won't be able to definitely tell you that. But anyway, so he starts with introduction. He then classifies the fast, and then he goes on to speak about the obligatory fast, which is the month of Ramadan. And then he speaks about certain fiqh issues, about sighting the moon, the concept of ru'ya, and so on and so forth. So this is basically, it goes on, and it has approximately 89 different sections by which the scholar discusses certain aspects of fasting, but it seems that there are many other aspects that are not really related to fasting in and of itself, but are kind of significant around a particular issue. For example, i'tikaf, for example, that is the staying and residing in the masjid during the last 9 to 10 days of the blessed month of Ramadan, the masjid, for example, and so on and so forth. The nights of Qadr also I mentioned, and so on and so forth. So this is all the different aspects that he's mentioned, breaking the fast of another believer, and so on. So this is some of the stuff that he mentioned in the book. So inshallah, for the benefit of our dear listeners, we will read a small portion of it in our next segment, inshallah. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we have introduced during this last and blessed month of Ramadan is a book titled Ibn Arabi and the Mysteries of Fasting, which was translated by Aisha Bewley and translated by the great works of the Islamic world, or great books of the Islamic world. So we're reading a small section from the book, section 3.5, regarding the glorious Quran. So 3.5. The Quran was sent down in Ramadan. Then God Almighty sent down the Quran in this month in the best night, which is called the night of power. He sent it down, and it is that in which the Quran is sent forth as a guidance for humanity and clear portents of the guidance and the criterion between right and wrong, since it is Ramadan. As for it being on the night of power, he sent it down with clear portents. That is, we made it clear that it is a book. The thing is clearly a book, a Quran and a criterion. These are different ranks which those who know God know. The Messenger of God forbade that we say Ramadan, since he said there is nothing, since he said there is not anything like him. Had that been said, there would not have been a like in this name. That is why he connected the expression month to it, so being like other months is negated. There is not anything like him that remains in his proper rank for every aspect. So with that, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in these last remaining days and nights to give us the ability to make use if we had not been, and to make more use if we have been, of this blessed month of Ramadan. And most importantly, to give us the ability to be alive and to make use and to be of those who enter into the next Shah Ramadan, inshaAllah, and hopefully in that Shah Ramadan we will be of those who are in the company of our Imam, Imam al-Sahib al-Asr wal-Zaman, inshaAllah. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
يستمعون القول فيتبعون
The Limelight.
Donald Trump has posted a $175 million bond in his New York civil fraud case as he appeals the court's decision. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants have secured a $175 million bond in their New York civil fraud case, according to court filing. Donald Trump secured the bond through Knight Specialty Insurance Company, which is owned by the privately held Hanke Group, whose chairman told ABC News that he considers himself a Donald Trump supporter. This is what we do at Knight Insurance, and we're happy to be able to accommodate the ex-president in this situation, Don Hankey told ABC News. He added, I'd say it's more of a business decision, but I happen to be a supporter also. Don Hankey said his company was initially involved in talks to underwrite the original $464 million bond in the case. Then when a New York appellate court last week reduced the amount to $175 million, Hankey said his company renewed their effort to underwrite the bond. It was a relatively low number, and Donald Trump put up all the collateral in cash, Don Hankey said. Hankey could not recall if Donald Trump also used bonds as collateral for the finalized bond, noting that his company reviewed some of the former president's bonds, which he said were as grade A bonds, investment grade quality securities. We're confident that we have very good collateral, Hankey added. Hankey told ABC News that he has contributed to the former president's campaign, but could not recall the amount that he had donated to Trump's campaign. An official with the New York Attorney General's office declined to comment to ABC News. As promised, President Trump has posted the bond. His attorney, Alina Haber, said in a statement on Monday evening, 1st of April. He looks forward to vindicating his rights on appeal and overturning this unjust verdict. Last week, a panel of judges from New York's Appellate Division granted the former president, his adult sons, and two former Trump Organization executives a 10-day stay of the $464 million judgment in their civil fraud case and permitted them to post a reduced bond of just $175 million. Trump's lawyers had argued that the former president lacked the cash to secure a bond for the full judgment after being rejected by more than 30 bond companies. Without intervention from an appeals court, defense lawyers argued that Trump would suffer irreparable harm by having to sell off his namesake properties before he exhausted his appeal of the fraud ruling. In February, following a three-month trial, Judge Arthur Engoron fined Donald Trump and his co-defendants after finding they had engaged in a decades-long business fraud by falsely inflating the former president's net worth to get better loans and business deals. Judge Engoron said, the frauds found here leap off the page and shock the conscience. Trump has denied all wrongdoing and his lawyers have appealed the ruling in the case, arguing that the disgorgement amount was unconstitutional, disproportionate and flawed. Defense lawyers argued that Judge Engoron misapplied the statute of limitations for Trump's conduct and the New York Attorney General Letitia James failed to prove Donald Trump's misrepresentations were relevant to the former president's lenders. There is no evidence and no finding by Supreme Court that the relevant lenders and insurance would not have given defendants loans and policies on the same terms in the absence of the supposed misrepresentations, defense lawyers said in a March filing. If their appeal fails, the former president and his co-defendants will be on the hook for the entire $464 million judgment. If Trump does not have the cash to cover the full judgment and his appeal is unsuccessful, Letitia James could enforce the judgment by seizing Donald Trump's assets. If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets, Letitia James said in a recent interview with ABC News. The cable news network CNN has also covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has posted a $175 million bond as he appeals the judgment against him in the New York civil fraud case brought by State Attorney General Letitia James. Donald Trump's bond pauses any action that Letitia James could take against Trump's properties in response to the judgment until at least September, when the state appeals court also set a schedule to hear his appeal for the $464 million verdict against him. The bond is underwritten by Knight Specialty Insurance, a Los Angeles, California-based insurance company, but the court document does not list the collateral that Donald Trump has used to secure the bond. Last month, Trump said at a news conference he would use cash to cover the bond, but claimed that he also wanted to use cash to fund his re-election campaign. Yet, asked if he planned to start personal funds into his presidential campaign, Donald Trump said, "First of all, it's none of your business." He added, "I might do so. I have the option." The bond amount was lowered by several hundred million dollars by a state appeals court last month after Donald Trump's attorneys argued that covering the full bond on the $464 million verdict against him was not feasible. Donald Trump himself was ordered to pay $454 million. The $464 million includes the disgorgement for his two sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump. In January, Judge Arthur Engoron fined Trump and his co-defendants, including his adult sons and his company, $464 million, finding they fraudulently inflated the value of the former president's assets to obtain better loan rates. Trump has been given 30 days to post the bond for the full amount of the judgment while he appealed, as is required by state law, but his attorney said he could not find an insurance company to underwrite that large bond. That prompted New York State Attorney General Letitia James to take steps to prepare to seize Donald Trump's assets in the event that Trump failed to post the bond. When the 30-day deadline hit, however, the New York Appeals Court stepped in and lowered the bond to just $175 million, giving Trump an additional 10 days. As promised, former President Trump has posted the bond. Trump's attorney, Alina Haber, said in a statement. Haber added, "He looks forward to vindicating his rights on appeal and overturning this unjust verdict." Donald Trump has also posted a $91.6 million bond last month in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case, while he appeals that verdict against him. Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our
but our spirit will never die.
This is IRIB English Radio.
The headlines: people hold rallies across the world to mark International Guts Day in